This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 19th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 444. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, a former cabinet minister who became a political science professor. He's authored two books. He's George Abbott, British Columbia's new chief commissioner of the BC Treaty Commission. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. One of the biggest issues facing British Columbia politically, socially, and economically for a long time, First Nations land claims. The new commissioner, chief commissioner of the BC Treaty Commission is George Abbott. He spent 17 years as a member of the Legislative Assembly, 12 of those in BC Liberal cabinets. He's also an author and a political science professor. The new chief commissioner of the BC Treaty Commission, George Abbott, joins me on this edition of the podcast. George, first of all, for the audience, can you describe what the Treaty Commission is, its three functions, and the six-step process to treaty making?
Sure. And first of all, it's a great pleasure to join you, Bob. Always enjoyed talking to you in the past and really look forward to our discussion today. It's a really important one, as you've said. The Treaty Commission has a really important role in the province of British Columbia. It's our role and responsibility to try to facilitate treaty discussions and hopefully treaty conclusion in the discussion between, I think right now there's about 60 First Nations that are involved at some level in treaty discussions. The aim of the commission is to try to understand how to move hopefully all of the parties in those discussions, and the principal participants are the First Nations, obviously themselves, that have chosen to engage in the treaty process. The other important partners at the table are British Columbia, which often has the Crown lands that will form an important part of treaty settlement lands, and Canada. And Canada, of course, has constitutional responsibility for Indigenous people and the lands that are reserved for them. So they take a very important role in the discussions as well. And the Treaty Commission also attends. Very often, personnel from the Treaty Commission will chair the treaty discussions. They try to facilitate progress in those discussions. I think that the commission has an important role in trying to better understand why some nations are proving effective in moving forward in the treaty process while others are not. I think we need to continue to try to understand the dynamics between progress or the lack of it in treaty discussions. And to your question, the parties to a treaty negotiation go through a series of stages. Obviously, stage one is just deciding that they want to participate, and that's often an important question for the First Nations themselves, whether they want to engage. There's a significant commitment for a First Nation in doing so. Then they gradually move through these different stages in the process. Eventually, when you get to stage five, which is pretty darn close to initialing, most of the issues have been sorted out at stage five. There's still important discussions often going on around finalization of treaty settlement lands. There may also be discussions around finalization of language around, for example, how forest fires will be managed in the treaty nation, or how children and family development services will be managed. But those are close to being completed. And the final thing before moving into the stage six is, first of all, the community initialing. The First Nation is the first, or in some cases, First Nations, because some of them are in multiple First Nations completing a treaty together. Timok on Southern Vancouver Island is a good example of one of those. They hope to initial, get community initialing and community ratification of their treaty later this year. One hopes so. And then it's on to ratification at the legislature. And there are three treaties, I'm excited to say, three treaties, Comox, Kitsilas, and Kitsum-Kalum, that will be considered by the BC legislature in 2026. That's a huge number relative to how we've done in the past. So that's great. We're really looking forward to that. And additionally, looking forward to seeing additional First Nations in 1, 2, or 3 years be bringing their initialed and community ratified treaties to the legislature as well. So all exciting. I think we have, and I'll conclude on this point, Bob, I think we have for the first time that I've seen in the now 35 years of the BC Treaty Commission, we are seeing a little bit of momentum behind the progress of First Nations at the treaty tables. I think there's reasons for that, and I'll talk about those, I'm sure, a little bit later. But I think we're seeing some momentum, and what I'd love to see as the incoming Chief Commissioner of the BC Treaty Commission is sustaining that momentum, really having First Nations believe, perhaps for one of the first times, that their nation is a great candidate to see its historical injustices resolved through commission processes and treaty processes.
So once those three are ratified and passed through the legislature this year, that'll bring to 10 the modern treaties that are implemented?
Yeah, it will be. It'll be 10. One of those is a multi-nation treaty, the Manulth Treaty on Vancouver Island, involves five First Nations. So it'll be 10 treaties and 15 nations that have now enjoying the opportunities and the resources that come with being a treaty nation in the province of BC.
The Cowichan and Tribes decision last year, after many, many years of the public being told that private land was not on the table, suddenly it came to be. And that is a very complex, long-running court case. And there are First Nations like the Musqueam, which are not on the same page as the Cowichan, and they're part of the appeal too. How has that made it more difficult for the BC Treaty Commission to achieve its goals? Or could there also be an opportunity there that it could provide First Nations who are thinking of litigation, get them to think twice to go the negotiation route?
I think the options of litigation versus negotiation, of course, been around for a long time. And really a major part of the story of British Columbia's eventual shift from asserting extinguishment of Aboriginal title in the province, a view that they maintained right up until the very late 1980s and into the early 1990s. It took a long time for the province to give that up, but the start of them being moved off that position was the Calder decision in 1973. Calder saw the federal government move its position around extinguishment and a much more favorable view of engaging in treaty. And of course, Calder was initiated by the Nishka. They had been the proponents of treaty for a long time, historically, right back into the 1880s. They visited the legislature and asked for treaty discussions. But they went to litigation to try to get the negotiation path opened. Ultimately, they were successful in that. As you know, the Nisga Treaty was negotiated outside the parameters of the new treaty commission, but it was completed in 1999, I think finally signed off by the Governor General 2000. But that was that opened up the negotiation path, and a lot of First Nations have entered that path. A number of them have been early on frustrated by that path and have either moved off and are just holding their ground at the moment, or some have on occasion embraced litigation as the route forward to resolving their issues. So Wasson, that you mentioned, is I think a really interesting case both in terms of the implications of modern treaty, but also the historical roots of the Tsawwassen drive for nationhood. Is a really interesting story. In 1873, the federal and provincial governments had a tentative agreement on a formula for expanding and creating reserves in the province of 20 acres per family. First Nations were not happy with that formula, but the federal and provincial governments had agreed to it. The provincial government reluctantly, as it turned out, you know, one of the places where the proposition of 20 acres per family as the formula for reserves was Tsawwassen. And the so-called Indian Commissioner of the day, Powell, took a survey crew to Tsawwassen, reported back to the relevant provincial ministers that in order to meet the 20-acre formula, Tsawwassen Reserve would have to be expanded by, I think it was 150 acres or something. It was pretty modest. But the province recoiled at that, said, you know, no deal, and essentially it drifted away, and Tsawwassen got to live with their very small reserve right up until the discussion of treaty. They were able to expand, and of course it's much tougher to see an expansion of Tsawwassen or Musqueam, where the survey crews were also on hand. Much more difficult in a province of 5.1 million British Columbians versus the, I think it was 8,576 white settlers that were in the province at Confederation. So it's gotten more difficult, but the Tsawwassen, to their credit, were very committed to the process. I got to work on some aspects of that as a minister in government at the time, but they were very determined. They have succeeded in becoming a treaty nation, I think effective 2008, and we're starting to see the benefits now of treaty making for the Tsawwassen. The Deloitte organization did a report for the commission on the economic benefits that have flowed from treaty for Tsawwassen. They're very substantial. Tsawwassen's doing very well. They are in a wonderful urban strategic location, but they didn't get there without a lot of effort. And so I'd say Tsawwassen is a great example of how a treaty can produce benefits. As you've observed, some nations will be very skeptical, may step out. But the more we can demonstrate success in the treaty process, I think the more nations that will say, okay, litigation's tempting, but it's expensive and the outcomes are uncertain. Negotiating a path forward, you have far much more certainty of what you're going to have at the end of the line than you do when you litigate with either the federal or provincial governments or both. You may win, but there's, as you observed, there's the three stages: BC's Supreme Court, then the BC Court of Appeal, then the Supreme Court of Canada, where the final word would be rendered what you see at the BC Supreme Court may or may not be reflected in the Supreme Court of Canada's final decision and final direction on that. So it's a bit of a gamble versus, I think, litigating versus versus negotiation. That's the preferred route from my view.
I wonder if historically, in the last 25 years or so, if government sometimes has gotten in the way of the Treaty Commission.
I spent much of the last 5 years, 6 years, researching and writing a book called Unseated. I have it right here. Understanding British Columbia's colonial history and why it matters now. One of the conclusions that I'd reach from the way in which First Nations were dealt with in the late colonial period, that is after the retirement of Governor James Douglas, into the what I would call the Trutch era, the late colonial period, early decades of post-Confederation provincial governments in British Columbia, there's a lot of reasons why First Nations would distrust the federal and provincial governments and would distrust any process that that those governments put in front of First Nations. So I respect that there's a lot of mistrust. I also know that to some extent the interest in treaty discussions is reflective also of how historically some First Nations had never generous but reasonable reserve allocations, but many of the coastal ones where the province argued that coastal First Nations are all fishers. They don't need the land. They get their sustenance from the ocean. They do not need any agricultural land. They don't need large reserves. So it's often the reserves, sometimes down to a half an acre per person on some of the smallest reserves created. There's a lot of anger, a lot of mistrust that is generated by that treatment historically. There hasn't been a lot of avenues to reverse the injustice or remediate the injustices that came out of the late colonial and early provincial periods. The treaty path is now open, and I think what we need to do as a commission is be patient, be honest, be genuine, be generous as well in terms of giving First Nations an understanding of how the treaty process can potentially remediate injustices that they've been living with in some cases for 170 or 180 years. So I think that's important. I also say that in the last 5 or 6 years, there's been some really important changes made with respect to treaty processes that we want to ensure that every First Nation is familiar with. So there's been a shift so that First Nations do not now have to give up their Section 87, I believe they're called. It's the template for a taxation on reserves. So they don't have to give up the opportunity to enjoy freedom from taxation on reserve, own source wealth generated or revenue generated. There's been change with respect to treaties not now being final and one and done. Treaties now, if for example a First Nation decides after a period of several years as a treaty nation that they want to do more on children and family development, the legislature and Parliament can look at those suggested changes. So it's a little bit more of a living document now than it's been in the past. And also, and I'll conclude on this point, it's a long answer, but there's been an important shift with respect to First Nations not having to carry the debt of treaty negotiation the way they did 10 years ago. So I think all of those things hopefully will restore treaty as an appropriate path forward. I mean, I salute Musqueam and Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh for the great work that they have done developing the resources that they have. In some cases, they've done incremental agreements with the federal government or provincial government, and they're turning those into areas of value. And again, good for them. But I will always want the treaty path to be open to them as well. But I think that's the way we get some certainty in this province, rather than seeing one legal action pop up 1 week in one area, legal action in another week, and so on. I think the public finds that quite disquieting. If we can have more engagement on treaty, I think that's the positive, constructive, and most certain route forward.
The two different approaches, the James Douglas approach and the Joseph Trutch approach, both from the 19th century, in so many ways, we're seeing those two approaches in conflict right now here in the 21st century. You were part of the Gordon Campbell governments, and Gordon Campbell, under his premiership, took reconciliation forward. The symbols that we saw before the Olympics, when the Sea to Sky Highway was opened, for instance, the bilingual signs, the signs that are in English as well as the Coast Salish languages to geography up and down the Sea to Sky Highway. But we have also seen other conflicts and which have become controversial. We're coming up on the fifth anniversary of the Tkamloops announcing what they said at the time were 215 unmarked graves of children, the Tkamloops Indian Residential School. Still, almost 5 years later, we don't have the evidence. Many British Columbians have seen statues torn down and First Nations names appear on street signs. That's caused also some friction. Yet we do see that many First Nations and First Nations people continue to be at a historical, socio-economic disadvantage, although many want to become full members of Canadian society. So how does the Treaty Commission get reconciliation back on track?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, again, lots to talk about there. So I'd say, first of all, that one of the roles of the Treaty Commission is education. We go out, we talk to local governments, we talk to schools, we talk to community organizations. I love talking, so I'll talk to literally anyone in the province who wants to better acquaint themselves, first of all, with the history of British Columbia, how we got here, just as importantly, how do we move beyond the contemporary, often unconstructive situation that we're in. So there has been actually, it's interesting to say, there's a vigorous debate today. There was also a vigorous debate 160, 170 years ago among federal, provincial, and other officials around how First Nations issues should be managed in the province. The Governor General in 1872, 1873, 1874, would visit British Columbia, and he would come and he would encourage the provincial government, who weren't taking the bait at all, but he encouraged, he cajoled provincial governments on the importance of 1763, which you mentioned a little bit earlier. He said that it is incumbent upon the provincial government to sit down with First Nations and negotiate value for their rights in the land. There was a vigorous debate. And it wasn't so much the Macdonald government, the Conservative government at the time of BC's entry into Confederation, but the subsequent Alexander Mackenzie government, a Liberal government, pushed British Columbia and its cabinets very hard for more generous reserve allocations. They'd pretty much given up on the prospect of cajoling the province into participating in the numbered treaty processes that were going on east of the Rocky Mountains in Canada. But that debate's been going on for a long, long time. The provincial position was very much established by BC's first lieutenant governor, Joseph Tretch. He took the position that notwithstanding the 14 treaties that James Douglas had done on Vancouver Island, he took the position that Indigenous or Aboriginal land title had been extinguished, that they had no right to any land in the province. The generosity of Crown, as they would put it, saw these very meager, often very marginal allocations for reserves, but First Nations were not, and I'd understand, I'd capitalize and underline not, they were not given the same opportunities on the land that my ancestors in Canada were given on the land. And I've had several generations of my ancestors enjoy the opportunity for preemption to take up 160 or 320 acres at very limited cost. That was denied First Nations. And so a lot of injustice flowed. I think we see a little bit of that same debate, the Tretch-Douglas debate, occurring today. There's still some arguments being made that, oh, we can just argue that Indigenous rights to land have been extinguished. That's been refuted by a series of Supreme Court decisions. People can argue whatever they want, but they're going to be wasting their time and their money arguing extinguishment. I think the question is, how do we get certainty back for broader British Columbia in terms of resource development and so on? How do we get that certainty back, but at the same time acknowledge that we have created injustices over our history, and that we have paths forward for reconciliation, for remediation of those injustices? And I think that, to me, the treaty path is the most important and viable of those paths. Non-treaty agreements like the Lake Babine Nation Foundation Agreement offer some land, some federal resources, dollars as well. So there's different ways of doing this. I may like treaty as the incoming chief commissioner of the treaty process, but there's other ways, and we can encourage and facilitate non-treaty agreements as well as treaty agreements. Anything in my mind that restores an opportunity and restores choices that were historically denied by our history, we should look at all kinds of paths to remediating those kinds of issues.
After the Kakathla decision and the BC Court of Appeal, which said that UNDRIP actually is a law that applies, it's not just a blueprint as what Horgan and Leader Eby said, but it's a law that applies throughout the province. And you've got the premier now saying that instead of amending the law, or definitely not repealing as the opposition wants him to do, he wants to pause certain sections temporarily while the courts give better definition of what is actually going on.
There's a lot swirling in the political environment right now with respect to DRIPA and a whole series of issues, some of them stemming from the Cowichan Tribes versus Canada decision of last August. But there's lots going on and lots to talk about. I think I take some comfort in recent visits that I and other members of the Treaty Commission team spent in Victoria. So we've met a couple times with the opposition Conservative Caucus. We've met with the Green Caucus. We've met with the Government Caucus. We've met with independent members. I haven't met Ms. Brody yet, but I'm sure that's a pleasure that awaits me at some point in the future. But we have met with virtually all of the members of the Legislative Assembly. So one reassuring point, I never heard during the hours that we spent in the legislature anyone say that the treaty process was unconstructive or useless or should be done away with, or I never heard any theme like that. I heard routinely and regularly that they were looking for better results from the commission. They were looking for faster results from the commission, but no one said this is a futile effort and should be done away with. I think this, so first of all, there's very broad support for treaty and treaty processes in the legislature, and I intend to continue to work as we have with both sides of the legislature just to make sure that we understand fully the expectations that the legislature has for us. So look forward to that. DRIPA, certainly, I spent 17 years in the provincial government. I can say that I'm glad that I'm not in government, and I'm glad that I don't have to try to figure this one out. I think the core of it is that the legislature, when it unanimously adopted the DRIPA Act in 2019, I think they believed it was an aspirational document, but now, as you observed, it's being interpreted by at least some in the courts as being more than aspirational, that in fact there's specific benchmarks that should be met by governments as they pursue agreements non-treaty agreements in the province. So we'll see. I think the premier, as I understand from the latest news I've seen, still looking at what will be the most constructive path forward with First Nations. I hope that he and the government are successful in finding a route forward that can be saluted by First Nations as well as by government. It's going to be difficult, no doubt, but happily it's not within the direct purview of the Treaty Commission to sort that one out. But we certainly, whatever we can do to help both First Nations and government through this period, and again, hopefully into a period of very constructive relations again, I'll be looking forward to that.
Now, you were nominated originally in 2015 to be the Chief BC Treaty Commissioner. That didn't happen, vetoed by the Clark cabinet at the time. But finally, in 2026, you're becoming the BC Treaty Commissioner. So what do you think are the differences and similarities between the challenges that are faced by the present government in this economy, in this political environment, with what you saw firsthand when you had a front row seat in cabinet with the BC Liberals, which inspired, of course, your book, Big Promises, Small Government?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So there'd probably be some interesting parallels between that 2001 to 2005 period of BC Liberal government. It continued on after that, but there was a pretty striking contrast between how government was managed 01 to 05 and what occurred after 05, when we started enjoying some surplus budgets again. Clearly, the deficit challenge that we had back in 2001. There's some parallels with the challenges that the current government has with respect to its very substantial deficit. The lessons I took from my book, Big Promises, Small Government, are really very detailed and critical look at a government I was a part of, 2001 to 2005. You can, I think, as a government, exacerbate the challenges you're already dealing with by taking actions which you believe, but may not, in fact, improve the situation. So one of the first things that Gordon Campbell did straight out of the gate, I don't think cabinet had even met when he announced that British Columbia was going to enjoy a 25% tax cut. And that was pretty much across the board, 25% tax cut. That had the impact not of immediately stimulating the economy as one dreamed, that suddenly there'd be enough economic activity because of that tax cut that government would be seeing revenues that it had never seen before. It's part of the American economic theory that a tax cut is a stimulus that would in fact produce more revenues rather than less. In British Columbia's case in 2001, the tax cut was made at a time when there wasn't a recession, but there was close to zero growth. As a consequence, all of the revenue that was lost via the 25% tax cut, which is a very big tax cut, 10% probably would have been seen as bold. 25% was huge. As a consequence, particularly in social service ministries, and I led one of those, we were forced to make some really awful choices about making cuts to programs that were really important so that we could meet the deficit goals over 3 years of the Campbell government. So it wasn't a lot of fun on that end, I can tell you, but more significant than that, I think there's a lot of vulnerable and disadvantaged people who came up on the short end of support from the government. So I would never suggest to any government that the way to deal with a deficit problem is to increase or to cut taxes and hope for the growth. You may get some over time, but growth tends to more reflect what's going on south of the border and elsewhere in the world than it does our sort of microeconomic policies in BC. We enjoy robust growth when the rest of the world and when particularly our neighbors to the south are enjoying robust growth. And I think what we need to do as governments is to try to marshal our resources in ways that, yeah, stimulate the economy if we can do that, find new opportunities for growth, but also bear in mind that the vulnerability of vulnerable people doesn't go away just because we say it has. So it's a huge challenge for governments, but the 25% tax cut was an ideological response based on the presumption that a cut of that magnitude would stimulate such economic growth that we would come out of it very quickly. We did not come out of it quickly. We came out of it slowly, but we did come out of it, as I'm sure for the present government. We will come out of the dilemma we have too. Unfortunately, for all of us, the American president seems determined to do really catastrophic damage, not only to the American economy, but to ours as well. And so, you know, when he does what he does in Iran, or when he does what he does around punitive tariffs, it makes it that much more difficult for our provincial government and our federal government to climb out of their debt and deficit challenges. So, and it's a complex world. And again, I'm glad I'm kind of way more on the sidelines than I was 15 years ago.
When it comes to running for the leadership of a major political party, in this case, the Conservative Party of BC is in the midst of their leadership. Do you have any observations or advice for any of the leadership contestants who are involved in this process, which is really a lot like a marathon? It's definitely not a sprint. Or do you have any reflections on your experience that the public should know about?
No, I'm glad to reflect on that period of my life. So yeah, I finished relatively close third. I wasn't far behind Kevin Falcon on that first ballot, but he was far enough ahead that that he got to stay on for the next round. I did not, but you know, we ran a great campaign. I think it's always challenging for whether it's an MLA or anyone else, for someone from a rural corner of British Columbia, like the Shuswap, to run for premier and to be able to gather enough regional support to get on the final ballot and hopefully to do well on that final ballot. I think one of the reasons I did reasonably well was I had a lot of caucus support when I made the run. I don't think there's a lot different that I would do. I would say that you know, I probably maximized the amount of support that I was going to get in the party. I didn't enjoy the connections to the great metropolitan population in and around Vancouver, Fraser Valley, and so on. That's my area of weakness. If it was the rest of the province outside the Lower Mainland, I would have been premier, I'm sure. But I wasn't. I did not secure enough support in the metropolitan area to do that. So I think, you know, getting around the province is really important. And I think all the candidates in the current Conservative run are doing that. I think another important factor for the Conservative, I mean, they have their own issues and actually Indigenous relations and how to manage them is one of the areas of debate and discussion in the current Conservative leadership campaign. But one of the things that I think made it tough for Kevin Falcon and I back in 2010, 2011, when this leadership marathon completed for the Liberals. Both Kevin and I were in government. At that point in time, you'll remember very well, the harmonized sales tax was a huge issue politically. I think both Kevin and I were tainted by that connection. Christie had stepped out of government a few or several years earlier. So she was a CKNW radio host and could say what she wished about harmonized sales tax, if anything at all. But she was not quite tarred by the same brush that Kevin and I were. And I think, you know, fortunately for the Conservative candidates, they don't have something like that to kind of pack on their backs as they're going through this exercise. But, you know, I'm happy with the outcome. It would have been very interesting to have an opportunity to be premier and probably a little bit more progressive than many of the other candidates in the races. But that's what we get to live with. And I'm happy with my life, notwithstanding being unsuccessful in a leadership run.
Well, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast, George Abbott. And well, because you were unsuccessful, you did become a professor of political science and wrote two books. The latest one is called Unseated, Understanding British Columbia's Colonial Past and Why It Matters Now. And of course, you are now the chief commissioner of the British Columbia Treaty Commission. So very important jobs, important issues. And thank you for your time to share the thoughts and answer my questions here on the Breaker.News podcast.
It's been a great pleasure to join you, and please invite me back again. It'll be interesting to, in 6 months or a year or 2 years, see where we're at. And my answers may not change, but I suspect your questions are going to change. And because I mean, it's going to be an interesting and dynamic period ahead. And I'd love to have the opportunity to join you again. It's great to see you and to see your many listeners. All the best.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, why are Taiwan's airlines bidding big on North America? From the second half of 2025 to present, China Airlines has added Phoenix as a new destination, EVA Air has expanded into Dallas, and will soon launch a new Washington, D.C. route. And newer carrier Starlux Airlines has moved into Ontario, California, and Phoenix. North America is not only a destination market, but a cornerstone of Taiwan's ambition to establish itself as a regional aviation hub to overcome its small domestic market and capitalize on changing transit flows, global supply chain shifts, and evolving geopolitical dynamics. These routes add around 20 direct flights per week between Taiwan and the United States. In ABC News Australia, why Australia turned to Brunei to shore up its supplies of critical crop fertilizer during Middle East war. Australia imports more than two-thirds of its nitrogen fertilizer urea from the Middle East, but the ongoing conflict and closure of the Strait of Hormuz has disrupted the flow. The synthetic compound is critical for producing high yields out of many crops grown in Australia, such as wheat, barley, and oats. In mid-February, urea cost about $700 per ton to import into Australia. That has since shot up to more than $1,500 per ton, according to estimates compiled by Episode 3. In Kyoto News, Japan PM pledges $10 billion in financial aid to Asia to tackle oil shortage. The Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takeuchi emphasized that the latest supportive scheme does not include direct crude oil provisions from Japan's reserves and therefore will not negatively affect domestic supplies. Japan imports petroleum-derived products from Southeast Asia, including items used at medical facilities. Many countries in the region maintain limited oil reserves, as there have been concerns that supply shortages could eventually affect shipments to Japan.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, contract details released for Oregon State men's basketball assistant coaches. Michael Plank and Danny Yoshikawa are each earning more than $250,000 salary. Justin Arginal is earning just over $200,000, and Dominic Lippi is earning $160,000, according to their contracts released to the Oregonian and Oregon Live in response to a public records request. In Cascadia Daily News, DOJ moves to vacate January 6th riot convictions for Proud Boys leader from Washington. Ethan Nordine is one of a number of Capitol rioters from the far-right groups known as the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, for whom the Justice Department asked a federal appeals court to wipe away criminal convictions. Meanwhile, Whatcom County courts expand virtual access after immigration arrests. The decision comes after a series of detainments by Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers outside of the Whatcom County Courthouse in apparent violation of state law.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to filmmakers, musicians, authors, writers, computer coders, people creating art, people creating design in British Columbia. April 20th to 24th is Creative Industries Week in British Columbia. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 19th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 19th of April in 2001, 25 years ago, the Space Shuttle Endeavour was launched and it was carrying Canadarm2 to the International Space Station? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. Also go to thebreaker.ca. And bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too and sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. Or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.